to What You Missed This Week. I'm Joe Weisenthal. This podcast has some of our favorite interviews from the Daily Market Close Show that I co-anchor along with Romain Bostic and Caroline Hyde. What You Miss? It's the perfect way to kick off your weekend. This week was another wild one for the lumber market. U.S. futures hovering below a record high as daily trading bumped up against daily limit up and down prices all within a couple of hours on Thursday. We got some perspective on how these insane lumber prices and supply shortages are weighing on the U.S. housing market from Rick Palacios, principal and director of research at John Burns Real Estate Consulting. We started by asking Rick the question that's been confounding us all. With home prices so high, why can't we just build a lot more houses to bring the prices back down?
If builders could do it, they definitely would. Yeah, no, I've been listening to you guys talking about CPI, and I mean, inflation is everywhere except for CPI right now, and I think housing is really the poster child for that.
I mean, what got us here, though, Rick? I mean, was this really an issue of just too little supply and too much demand, or were there sort of just maybe regional factors that maybe played into why we're seeing this imbalance?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, I think inflation may be a bit more transitory. It may stay longer in housing than other kind of industries that we're all talking about. I mean, ketchup packets, that's going to relieve itself pretty soon here, I'm thinking. But when you think about housing, you've got these supply chain bottlenecks that have been just on steroids post-COVID. So land, labor, materials, municipalities. And then, so that's kind of the norm across really the entire economy right now. But then you layer on top of that, there is just insane demand for housing right now. And I think housing as a whole has had a captive audience on really the entire consumer. I think some of that is going to start to wean here as we get into the latter half of this year in 2022.
And are there any areas that there hasn't been demand? Is it the whole spectrum, the whole price point gamut that we've been seeing in housing, or has it been the suburbs that do particularly well? Has it been the less affordable housing, the like plus 1 million? What about those that are on the lower income spectrum but wanting to buy their first home?
Yeah, no, so we rank this on a monthly basis through a survey we do about 300 home builders across the country. And it's demand is insatiable across every buyer segment right now. So entry level price points, move up, second home, luxury. I mean, across the board, builders are having a hard time keeping up with demand. And that's one of the reasons why, if you look at just home prices, so we have this data now from April from our survey, new home prices up 16% year over year in April. That's the highest we've seen in the history of our survey.
Talk to us a little bit more about demand destruction. Where do you see, either because the houses just can't get built or because the prices are so nuts, like what do you see happening when the finally prospective home buyers say, you know what, I've had enough, I'll stick to renting, or I'll stick to whatever my current situation is and maybe look again in a couple of years?
Yeah, no, I mean, if you think about it in terms of our forecast, we do have growth moderating. And I think housing, 2021 is this very unique window in time for housing where it's just firing on all cylinders for a lot of the reasons we just talked about. But over time, and some of this is rates and inflation that is looking like it's going to start to accelerate and rates creeping up, we do have home prices moderating. We do have the rate of new home sales moderating, new home construction moderating. I mean, I think, you know, we talk about a captive audience, there is almost no resale supply in a lot of these markets where home builders are active. And so home builders really can kind of control the market where they're at and demand what they're demanding on the pricing front, because there's really no other game in town right now.
Yeah, that's certainly true. As we start to sort of get maybe a couple years out here, and maybe let's say you start to see a little bit more normalization with regards to things, how far out, I guess, on the risk spectrum are some of these builders? I know a lot of what they're building right now, they've kind of already locked in the potential buyers for that. But how far out do they normally go?
Yeah, well, it really depends. I mean, tying up land can take many, many years, namely here on the West Coast. I mean, one of the things that's been helping builders right now is that they acquired and bought the land that they're now monetizing through selling homes years ago. Mm. But when they're going to buy land right now, the homes that they're going to deliver on that land, it's not going to be for sometimes a year, 2 years. I mean, if you're on the West Coast here in California, many years out. And so that's where, we are starting to see some builders, and I think, Joe, this is what you referenced in that thread that I tweeted out last week, where builders just don't have, there's not a lot of comfort around the volatility in construction costs, in land costs, labor costs. And so what they're saying is, you know what, let's kind of pause here a little bit. Let's dial things back a little bit until we do have some more, some guardrails really around what's happening on the cost side so that we can price these homes more accurately to what we're seeing as a home builder in terms of the notices we're getting from vendors on a weekly basis sometimes that are ratcheting up our costs.
Talk to us about the labor part, Rick, and how, you know, are more people being channeled towards wanting to work within construction? Is the supply at any point becoming unbottlenecked there, or is there just not enough trained people?
I think it's probably a combination of everything, not a lot of trained people too, namely. I mean, this is something that we highlighted going back a decade coming out of the Great Financial Crisis. A lot of the trades and the labor pool that was in residential construction essentially left the industry during the Great Financial Crisis. Huh. And we have not seen those individuals really come back in mass, even though there is a ton of demand for their skills and their craft right now.
This is super interesting, and it's a really big theme. It seems to me, whether we're talking about lumber or in your, as your description, the trade to build, to actually know how to build a home, really atrophied in the sort of post-crisis period where we had this long slump, and now we're really paying the price for it.
Yeah, and a big part of that too, Joe, is that a lot of the trades pre-Great Financial Crisis, I mean, they came from outside the United States, and so we had immigration coming in. That essentially shifted, changed, and we haven't seen it reverse. I mean, a lot of the home builders I talk to say, gosh, we would love to have some sort of an immigration policy where we could get these people in working for us, path to citizenship. And so who knows, maybe we'll see that happen.
And so what's the next step here then? I mean, where do we go from here?
I think housing this year, 2021, this kind of goes back to my comments on this very unique window in time. I mean, we're gonna look back on 2021 and say, we had the strongest home price appreciation we've had since 2005. I think we're forecasting about 15% resale price appreciation. New home prices are going up higher than that. Crazy construction volume, but you know, builders, if they could build more, they would. It's just the bottlenecks right now are really limiting what they can do. I think when we get into 2022, a lot of the land that has been purchased over the last three quarters will start to hit in terms of community counts, and we'll finally have more supply. We'll finally get more resale supply coming online. And I think with that, you'll get price appreciation moderating to more, call it realistic levels.
When the charts would be a fine thing. Rick, your perspective on cities versus suburbs, both hot?
Yeah, I mean, you're starting to see articles pop up here and there now about how the cities are doing pretty well too in terms of transactions, in terms of finding a bottom. I mean, we've got a chief demographer who's been digging into this for many, many years. We actually wrote a book on this called Big Shifts Ahead years ago. And our view is that you were going to, and we were seeing the suburbs grow at an accelerated rate from what cities and urban core were. You had COVID hit, and just like with a lot of trends across a lot of industries, really that trend was just accelerated. And so it's something that we're seeing right now, and a lot of builders are more comfortable going further out because of what we're seeing with work from home and people saying, you know what, I can now be a little bit further out. I've only got to go into my office maybe 2-3 times a week. So I don't want to live in the city.
Now this week, What'd You Miss hosted a debate. We posed the question, has the economic cycle peaked and what does it mean for markets? We asked two of our frequent guests, Bloomberg Opinion columnist Connor Senn and Neil Dutta, the head of US economics at Renaissance Macro Research. We started with Connor, who has been warning about supply constraints for a while now on his new column, which argues that we're not going to be able to reach GDP goals if the labor market remains this tight. And we asked him why he thinks things have topped out and whether that poses a risk for stocks.
Well, I think the first sign that maybe growth is slowing, so we're still growing, but maybe at a slightly slower rate than the historically strong numbers we saw in March, was that ISM manufacturing survey we saw last week, which did come down from March's sort of historically high number. And some people might say, well, it's still a good number, but it is falling relative to what it used to be. And then, you know, we obviously have the jobs report where we didn't produce as many jobs as we thought we would. And it looks like that was really more due to supply bottlenecks rather than demand. And then on top of that, we've got increasing signs that maybe in the housing market, home builders are starting to pull back just because the material cost pressure is too insane for them, and they want to just sort of watch things shake out a little bit. So it seems like, you know, maybe demand growth is slowing a little bit, and then we're really hitting these supply bottlenecks a lot sooner than we thought we would.
But Neil, I mean, we're coming right now, for a lot of us are finally coming back out of the house for the first time in quite some time. People are looking to spend. You got accommodative Fed policy, and you have fiscal policy out there on the table.
No, I think that's right, and I think that's the fundamental story. I mean, when we talk about peak ISM, it's important to remember, I think, for investors, why that signal has such salience in the markets. And it's primarily because of the Fed, right? So when you have a peak ISM, you have rising prices paid, usually the Fed steps its foot on the brake. That's not happening this time around. I also think it kind of strains credulity to think that this is like 2010. Obviously, Europe was blowing up back then. So the fact that the data, you know, quote unquote, peaked in 2010, not that it actually did at the time, you know, it was more coincidental than anything else. Obviously, this time around, we have a phased reopening, not only in the U.S., but globally as well, right? So Europe is vaccinating more people, they'll reopen. Latin America will start vaccinating more people, they'll reopen. And obviously, EM Asia. And if you think about it, each of those economies subsequently are more open than the other. In other words, they trade more. So that's ultimately good for the manufacturing sector. So I think, you know, when we talk about data peaking, it's important to think about it in terms of momentum versus levels. And, you know, in terms of levels, we're not at peak anything. I mean, when you talk about order backlogs and customer inventory index, which is at a record low, that all suggests that production is likely to accelerate from here. Now, you know, I take Connor's point about certain bottlenecks arising, and that may slow down growth. But if you're an investor, what do you do with that? You're going to revise up 2022. I mean, has the 12 to 18 month outlook really changed because of this? I think, you know, prices still send an important signal. If you're a lumber producer, what are you going to do? Cut production? I mean, so it's, you know, I mean, I think that if you're going to trade around this peak ISM story, it's a trade you want to rent, not own.
Neil, I really hope you're not peak cuddly toy situation either, because that is an excellent backdrop. Meanwhile, Connor, your perspective on, you know, this friction, how long it might remain. If we do start to see the supply chains get easier, the friction come off, people are vaccinated, they're no longer fearful of going back to work, the schools we hope reopen fully, women perhaps return to the labour force that much more easily. Does that mean that we could see this more later explosion of growth?
I think he's right about the 12 to 18 month view, but I think the market might really be focused on the next 3 to 6 months. And I think we're seeing that maybe these short term frictions are a lot more severe and longer lasting than we thought. You know, sort of last spring, maybe we thought that we'd be sort of through the lockdowns in 8 months, and or sorry, 8 weeks, and it turned out to be more like a year. And, you know, there was thought that maybe we'd have, okay, some transitory inflation this summer, and we're still going to get that. It looks like we have the CPI report tomorrow. But these bottlenecks just seem a lot tougher than maybe we thought even a month or two ago, and that's giving investors pause. And to Neil's point, you know, I think longer term investors might be saying, well, maybe it just pushes the growth onto 2022. But if we really do start getting these hot inflation prints, and if we get some downside surprises to growth, will investors be willing to hang on for the rest of this year when they thought that this year would be the big growth number and next year would be lighter? So I think we could see investors really struggle with the next 2 to 3 months of data.
Yeah, Neil, I want to talk about, I mean, obviously we're getting that CPI number tomorrow. You know, transitory base effects. We all know the story. But A, we do see companies whose results have been hit by some of the shortages and bottlenecks. Sawmills, which should be, you know, printing money right now, having issues with trucking. That's an effect. And then if you get hot numbers, you know, do people start to worry that either some combination of real earnings growth or real earnings hits plus, you know, Fed starting to waver a little bit, could that create some volatility for the market if maybe, I don't know, some of the regional Fed presidents come off message?
Well, they're actually getting, I mean, I guess I disagree with the premise of that, because they're actually coming on message. I mean, you've seen a number of, you know, traditionally hawkish regional Fed presidents actually buying in to Powell's strategy. Bullard is the latest among them, but you see it from Mester, you see it from Rosengren, Barkin from Richmond. I mean, these are regional Fed presidents that have been hawkish. So the Fed's going to pull the rug out from underneath it, just as you're getting more political buy-in from your lieutenants. I mean, that sort of seems, you know, absurd to me. So I don't think that, I think the Fed being easy is the name of the game. They'll be the last central bank to taper. That's going to be negative for the dollar. And that could mean some rotation into equities overseas. But when you talk about production, Joe, look, we're talking about 1 month, right? And every data point that went into that 1 month before it was stronger in terms of employment.
Right.
Right. I mean, we had rising employment in the Small Business Pulse Survey and ADP alongside rising openings. So does anyone really believe that the underlying trend in employment is 275,000? I mean, my sense is that it's probably closer to, you know, 700 than not. So as you're bringing those people on, you're going to get stronger rates of production. You know, we started the segment talking about ISM. The ISM, last I checked, is in expansion territory. That means we're going to see more industrial production growth. So, you know, these issues, and, you know, you talk about, you know, inflation biting into earnings. We're seeing net margins actually expand, which would suggest that the inflation that we're seeing is not actually eroding corporate profits. It's actually, you know, helping. So, I disagree with some of the premise of that. But, you know, I do feel like this is a trade you want. If you're going to play this, you want to rent it. You don't want to own it. And I also think it's maybe a little bit premature to be talking about this. I mean, you're talking, if you look at like equal weight equities in the S&P 500, I mean, that's still looking fine. You know, this is narrowed to us, I think, a specific set of names. And I do think that the economy is generally on a strong course. And, you know, look, I mean, the Atlanta Fed, I mean, Connor knows this because he's from there. That's tracking what, like 11%? You know, we're not really. I mean, you know, we're sort of you know, quibbling over little things here, but
we need quibbling. We need quibbling.
A strong trajectory.
This is a round table. We need some healthy disagreement.
Neil, you want to start with you. You have been a very big advocate of the sort of like the pure reopening trade, long Planet Fitness, short Peloton, things like that. Doesn't everyone know the economy is reopening, and doesn't everyone know that viruses? The vaccine rollout is picking up. Like, what more juice is there, in your view, in this trade?
Well, I guess, Joe, everyone knows except the public health apparatus in this country, right? I mean, the messaging, I think, has been somewhat mixed. So that may have taken some of the juice out of the reopening trade, as you see with what's gone on with the cruise lines recently, right? So, you know, it's sort of a two steps forward, one step back process. But I definitely do think that, you know, to some degree, I think I sympathize with the view that the reopening trade is has run its course. But this goes back to a point that, you know, we were talking about earlier is, you know, peak ISM. Investing does not stop when the ISM hits 60. I mean, I can't tell my clients that, you know, only invest in U.S. equities when we're going from 30 to 60. So, you know, now's the opportunity maybe to take some of that, you know, some of those profits and maybe rotate it into other areas of the capital markets. So I think that's the way to think about it. But I think the broad reopening, I mean, is still continuing. I mean, we just hit a record in terms of TSA screenings over Mother's Day. So there's still some, you know, I mean, the fundamental trend in the services economy is still up. And remember, in the first quarter of this year, service sector consumption in real terms was really no different than it was in the fourth quarter of last year. So again, when we talk about peak, we're going to see an acceleration in service sector consumption over the next two quarters, I think, that we haven't seen on a scale at certainly not in our lifetime. So, again, I think there's still a lot of momentum in that, at least in the economy. Maybe the equity story has run its course, but I think the momentum in the economy still has a ways to go.
So, Connor, where to put money to work in your thesis if we are indeed at potentially peak growth? I mean, you're the dip buyer in the NASDAQ, or where to put money?
Well, I think the risk is that the next jobs report looks just like the April one did. And that would really, I think, call into question the supply response. And maybe demand is really strong, but we just can't meet it supply-wise for whatever reason. And so in that environment, you have, you know, less than expected U.S. growth, maybe hotter than expected U.S. inflation. And maybe the Fed just, again, sits through this and lets it play out, which means that we're not getting the response from the Fed, which looks like a really weak dollar, sort of long commodity, long non-U.S. type story. And just sort of with the way that traders are kind of, you pick one thing and not the other, I think if commodities are doing well, tech probably doesn't, even if tech earnings are growing. And then I think also, you know, if housing kind of slows just from lack of supply, then home builders could be in for a rude awakening, and that whole housing-related supply chain that's done so well over the past 6 months.
I am curious here, Connor. I mean, we're getting to a stage where at some point we will sort of see some normalization of monetary policy, maybe a normalization of fiscal policy here. I mean, the real question here is whether this rebound, this economic recovery, can sort of stand on its own, whether we can transition to some sort of sustainable growth rate that isn't completely dependent on Jay Powell and on what Congress passes with regards to stimulus.
Well, I think it's, you know, in the last cycle, the mistake we made was trying to normalize monetary policy, which really was more like normalizing interest rates, whether or not the economy could handle the interest rates we got to. So I think the shift under Powell is more like, you know, what we have now is maybe normal. And, you know, normal doesn't necessarily mean 2-3% just to try to get there for no obvious reason. And, you know, if the economy needs that, then we lift rates to get us there. But it's not a goal in and of itself.
We leave it there, of course. Ding, 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 ding. That's the end of the fight. Joe, who won?
I'm 10-10. It was a draw. They both raised their hands.
Oh, snooze.
Sorry.
There you go, Joe.
I want them to both come back.
You're so diplomatic.
I'm biased. I want them to both come back.
This week, we also got more fuel for the inflation debate that's been gripping Wall Street investors. On Wednesday, we got April CPI data. U.S. consumer prices climbing by 0.8% last month. That's the most since 2009, outpacing economist estimates. Meanwhile, the core gauge rose by the most since 1982. This inflationary pressure has consequences beyond markets. Some Democrats worry that the data could put President Biden's spending plans, the American Jobs Plan, and the American Family Plan in political jeopardy. So we got some reaction from the White House off the back of that data from Mike Pyle. He's the chief economic advisor to Vice President Kamala Harris and a former chief investment strategist at BlackRock. And we asked Mike whether the surge in consumer prices will make passing the Biden administration's spending plans more difficult politically.
So we're staying focused on the economics and the overall strategy here. You know, the president and the vice president have talked about there being two major prongs to their economic strategy. First, around rescue. Around recognizing the hole that we were in by virtue of the pandemic. And the American Rescue Plan was focused squarely at that, getting shots in arms, getting relief in the hands of families and businesses. But we're now kind of looking to, here in Washington, that next stage around, as you say, the jobs plan, around the families plan. And that's really economically an entirely different problem that we're looking to solve. That is a multi-decade, a multi-year investment in our families and our infrastructure designed to allow the economy to grow faster, designed to allow that growth to be more inclusive, designed to allow us to take on the challenge of climate change. That isn't stimulus. That isn't the Recovery Act. That's a long-term investment focused on helping to build back better after decades of underinvestment.
And that's a great point. I mean, obviously you understand, though, the politics and how certain things will be framed, whether you want to frame that way or not. I'm wondering about the conversations that you're having there in the executive building about just the pace of economic growth and the idea here that by adding these programs on, you create potentially maybe a little bit too much stimulus. Even if it's not called stimulus, there's this idea that you're throwing logs onto the fire. And this seems to be what some people in the markets are concerned about. Is that conversation taking place?
Well, again, I would resist that characterization. I mean, take the American Jobs Plan, for instance. You know, that is a multi-year investment that is intended to, over the next 8 to 10 years, really transform our transportation infrastructure, our energy infrastructure, our broadband capacities, and it's going to be paid for in full through a set of tax changes on the business and corporate side over the next 15 years. You know, that is, again, that is not the right frame of mind. There is not stimulus. It's not about responding to the immediate moment. It's about structurally investing in this economy after decades of underinvestment to make the economy more productive and more inclusive over the decade and beyond.
I hear you, Mike, on the inclusion part of it, of course, something that you've been very focused on since coming into the role. But the fact that inflationary pressures drive up the cost of food, drive up the cost of gas, drive up the cost of things that the lower income can least afford price pressure on, how do you square that circle? How do you ensure that you're not hurting the victim you're trying to help?
Well, again, I would resist that characterization. So when we look at the inflation print today, you know, what we see is evidence of an economy that is rapidly normalizing coming out of the pandemic, and a reflection of having gotten a lot of shots in arms and allowing behavior, allowing social life, allowing travel to begin to get back to normal. So let's look underneath the hood of this inflation print. You know, we've said for some time we expect to see transitory inflation. We expect to see it in particular around parts of the economy that were especially hard hit by the pandemic. And I think in large part, that's what this print reveals. You know, look at places like airfares, look at places like hotel and leisure more broadly. There are very significant month over month gains there in terms of prices, but that's really a reflection of the fact that people feel more comfortable getting back into the economy, getting back into travel, getting back to moving again. And that is what we think was kind of ultimately a lot of what was going on in this print.
Mike, let me ask you a question about the here and now. There is clearly some tension about whether the UI expansion is contributing to a labor supply shortage. Record job openings, pace of job creation slower than expected. I don't think the data is a slam dunk, but there does seem to be some ambiguity. Would the White House be open to the legislation that would allow people who take a job to take with them a bonus of part of their future UI?
So I'm not going to get out in front of the legislative process. But what I will say is, you know, a couple of things. When we look at the data, yeah, we agree with you. It is not obvious that UI, with the data we have in hand, is having this effect. You know, that said, we recognize this is a moment when the economy is changing very rapidly. This is a historic moment. This is an unprecedented moment. This is a moment where the economy is changing day to day. And the data that we have in hand, you know, is a snapshot of the economy 4, 6, 8 weeks ago. So we're very much kind of vigilant around this, kind of paying attention to conditions on the ground day over day, given how rapidly things are changing, because we recognize the data that we have in hand, while not conclusive, is a snapshot of an economy that, you know, doesn't exist anymore in some ways.
Now is a wild 5 days for the world of crypto. Coinbase reporting earnings for the first time as a public company. Bloomberg learned that the U.S. Department of Justice and the IRS are investigating the world's largest cryptocurrency exchange, Binance. Meanwhile, Elon Musk delivering a blow to the sector with a major U-turn. The Tesla CEO suspending purchases using Bitcoin and voicing concerns about its energy usage just a few months after becoming one of the currency's most vocal supporters. So we got some reaction from longtime Bitcoin advocate Nick Carter, the founding partner at Castle Island Ventures. And we started by asking Nick the trillion-dollar question. Does Bitcoin ever have a plan to transition to a proof-of-stake system, or will it always rely on computationally intensive mining?
Well, Bitcoin doesn't have a plan because it has no leader and it's pretty decentralized. And when individuals or firms have tried to commandeer Bitcoin, they haven't been successful. So Bitcoin has no plan, but you know, the consensus in the community, to the extent it exists, is that proof of work is completely intrinsic to Bitcoin, and proof of stake is not really a desirable alternative, quite frankly.
All right, and some people reading in between the lines of what Elon Musk said seems to suggest that maybe he's eyeing an alternative here. Are there alternatives?
There's certainly many other systems that purport to do the same things that Bitcoin does. And there's many clones of Bitcoin and many blockchains 3.0 and so on. But at least in my view, none of them have proven to be sufficiently decentralized. And frankly, if you pull the proof of work element out of Bitcoin, you get something completely different. So a lot of Bitcoiners would question whether you can eliminate the proof of work and get a system with those same assurances.
Of course, some also saying maybe Elon Musk is just throwing down the gauntlet here. Make yourself run on cleaner energy, all you miners. So is that the answer? If Bitcoin does need to remain in some sort of digital gold, it's still about 40% of the ecosystem. Who wants to maintain that? Are people looking at ways of shifting to cleaner ways to mine it?
Absolutely. And, you know, there's a big distinction between an energy cost and then the actual carbon outlay, which people often miss, right? And it really depends on the source of energy you're using. Of course, we know that a large share of Bitcoin is mined, in particular in places like Sichuan, Yunnan, in the wet season with hydro. But we can do a lot better. And there are some great secular trends. Actually, the Chinese province of Inner Mongolia recently banned Bitcoin mining. And that was 70% coal powered. So if you actually look at the trends, they look to be improving structurally. We're seeing a lot more hash rate onshore onto the US. The US has a greener grid than China, so that's great. I'd like to see more from miners in terms of disclosing what their energy mix is, what their power sources are. But you know, certainly there's actually a lot of cause for optimism here around the energy mix of Bitcoin, quite contrary to the tone Elon is putting out.
Let me ask you a question. You write about Bitcoin's energy usage a lot. This debate, these points that you make about how there's a difference between energy use total and sort of carbon emissions because some of it's clean. Do you, as a participant in the industry, think that from a sort of like regulatory legal standpoint, that one of the bigger risks to the environment is that regulators crack down on it for precisely this reason, hence your motivation for writing about it so much?
The motivation to write about it is frankly because the debate is very poorly informed, and a lot of the critiques I see are just not really grounded in reality and you know, the facts of the protocol. Certainly, we're seeing capital becoming much more politicized and much more informed by ESG considerations in the U.S. And that's only going to continue. And, you know, every day I talk to large allocators that have trepidation about Bitcoin precisely because of the environmental impact of the system. So it absolutely doesn't affect everyone on the sort of capital allocation, capital management side of the industry. So it's already a consideration today, and I expect that will only continue to be the case as ESG gets fully normalized. Yeah. And so that would be the challenge that I would pose to Bitcoin miners. Miners tend to be long Bitcoin. They want to accumulate Bitcoin. So their duty is to render themselves as environmentally friendly as possible or buy carbon offsets if they can't.
Nick, I want to get your thoughts here on Coinbase. We did get that first earnings report out of the company today. Obviously, they had guided even before the direct listing, so we kind of knew the numbers. We did see pretty healthy monthly transaction numbers here, and they're actually guiding a little bit higher. What do you generally see here as sort of the bright spot for Coinbase going forward?
Well, Coinbase is a very straightforward business, frankly. You know, their revenues are very much a function of retail trading volumes, and those have been strong. They haven't really changed there. There's not a lot new there. So pretty much delivering exactly as expected. Of course, the price performance has been somewhat disappointing, and it's tracked sort of the broader crypto markets, but not a lot of surprises there. What I'd like to see would be if they can diversify their revenue a little bit and build in more lines of revenue mirroring the way that conventional exchanges operate, they tend to have larger data businesses. Few crypto exchanges monetize their data. And seeing if Coinbase can maybe monetize their AUM on a net interest margin model, perhaps, which they haven't done so far. So they still have plenty of room for growth, frankly.
Nick, of course, full disclosure, my husband's a senior manager over at Coinbase, so I won't pass over the numbers too much, but it is interesting that in some way, Coinbase gets pulled down when crypto falls, but inherently they make money off the volatility therein. Bitcoin currently trading 10% lower, but Ethereum down 10% as well. Even though we see yet another big institutional player hanging their hat in the crypto space, Steve Cohen's Point72, exploring blockchain, the crypto sector. I feel like you're going to say this is a buy the dip opportunity, but at what point does it actually correct? Do you see a significant sell-off coming to the crypto space?
We've sold off, I think, most of the sell-offs, partly to do with the, the Elon effect and so on and the disappointment around that, but also very saliently regulatory concerns, and that's going to affect the broader market. We see this Binance investigation today. I think a lot of people are starting to realize that this Gensler SEC is going to be much more aggressive, and the SEC commissioner is going to try and make his mark on the crypto industry. Frankly, a lot of these exchanges are hosting the trading of dubious products, things that resemble equity, things that might be, potentially brushing up against securities laws. It doesn't surprise me.
Nick, real quickly, we just have a couple of seconds. Is it a problem for Bitcoin that I can't buy dog tokens with it and that I have to use Ethereum instead?
I don't know if you want to be buying the dog tokens, Joe, frankly.
Okay.
Okay.
And that's it for What You Missed This Week.
If you like the show, make sure to subscribe and rate us at Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can catch our show every weekday from 3:30 to 5 p.m. on Bloomberg TV and from 4 to 5 p.m. on Twitter. Thanks for listening and have a great week.